Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Thank you for your patience this morning. The next case on our calendar today is A23-0546. Corey Pearson versus St. Cloud Hospital and Emergency Physicians Professional Association. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for your argument, and it's my understanding that the respondents are splitting their time equally. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So you will each have 7.5 minutes, and you can see the time in the grid view. The marshal will set the clock appropriately. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll just ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And we are recording the oral arguments here today. To anyone who's watching, no other recordings are permitted. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. My name is Sarah Jewell. As you mentioned, I represent the appellant, Corey Pearson, in this matter. She is also appearing from my office along with our associate attorney and law clerk. And thank you for hosting us this morning. So I'm going to try to keep this very brief. I know the briefings were pretty extensive and thick. So making just a few points here. When we look at Rule 56 summary judgment, we really need to look at, are there disputed facts? Were there information that could have further supported plaintiff's claims related to the motion to compel that was denied, which we're also appealing from, as well as the summary judgment motion ruling by the district court? And so those, I think, tie in really closely together. And I think that those are really important issues in this matter, especially because the respondent APA did concede at the oral argument, which was our oral argument on the motion to compel discovery, that the appellant was entitled to an in-camera review of documents that we had obtained, but which were either on a privilege log or had been heavily redacted, and privileges were being claimed. We had requested in-camera review under the rules. We believe we are entitled to that. EPA, in its oral argument, did concede before the district court that that was something we were entitled to have. However,
can I ask you about that?
Absolutely.
Can you speak a little more specifically about how the denial and reservation of the motions to compel discovery prejudiced your case?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. So we had sought in discovery from both defendants, although I'm going to speak first to more EPA, because I think that was the one which to me is a very easy conceded point that I think the court abused its discretion in just sort of overlooking that. The way that prejudice specifically was more to the negligent retention and negligent hiring claims that the plaintiff presented. And so in her deposition testimony, which is in the district court's record, which is a lengthy record, but it's document ID number 113. We submitted a full transcript of Ms. Pearson's deposition. In her deposition, she stated that after reporting the sexual harassment of Dr. Shipple and Dr. Johnson, she had been receiving, I guess, a lot of, you know, retaliation. And one of those doctors who retaliated was Dr. Butts. She then later, through a course of events of having trouble returning back to work, did speak with Dr. Curtis Belk. And he is the, or maybe still is, I guess I haven't checked lately, but was at that time the acting medical director for EPPA and had his own office actually inside the St. Cloud Hospital. In that meeting, which lasted over an hour, which Dr. Belk admitted in his deposition that meeting did last over an hour. However, he couldn't recall the details of what was discussed at that meeting. But in Corey Pearson's deposition, she testified that Belk told her all about the past history of these doctors, that Shipple had been known to have substance abuse problems, that he had appeared at a work meeting either drunk or under the influence of some type of chemicals or drugs or whatever, and that you know, they were trying to deal with him. And according to Corey's testimony, she said Belk was telling her this to try to like convince her that they were finally dealing with this issue. It was a known issue in the past. Those are the documents that we've requested and did not receive that we think would have been really crucial to the outcome of the plaintiff's claims, especially of negligent retention and negligent hiring. It also goes
wasn't the problem that the district court had with that particular claim that Minnesota law doesn't support a finding that emotional distress can, you know, be based on a psychological injury. So don't you need to prevail on that issue in order to show that this wouldn't be at best harmless error?
Thank you, Your Honor. So there, we do have both a physical manifestation of a physical injury in the form of a rash all over my client's body, like hives. She broke out in hives as a result of being retaliated against by her coworkers, one of which was an EPA doctor. That was seen by another coworker of hers, which was one of the other nurses. And we, again, under document ID number 113, we did provide that deposition transcript. That was Katie Gehring. She testified to seeing Corey breaking out in hives all over her body. That is a physical manifestation. That is a physical thing. You can see it. You can feel it. It's like hot boils or hot, I'm not really sure the best medical way to describe it, but it is a physical manifestation of what was going on in addition to the psychological injury. And so we do believe he had both.
Haven't we held previously that emotional distress that causes heart problems and anxiety disorders, for example, can't support this type of claim? That emotional distress ultimately is not a physical injury that can support the claims that you're raising here.
Yes, I am not aware of that. We've cited to the most apposite case law, I guess, that we feel supports that claim. And so I'll just rely on the case law that we've cited to in our brief. And we believe that it's more of the fact that we need to show both. And so we do feel we have both. We have both the physical manifestation in her body as well as the emotional distress. And I think on that claim, we're getting a little bit off because that's a separate claim from the one that we were talking about originally, which was whether the district court failed to hold the in-camera review, which goes to the negligent hiring and negligent retention claims, that they knew or should have known these were troublesome doctors, that they had a past history of affairs with other nurses. They had a past history of sexual harassment of other nurses in the emergency trauma center. That was a known fact, apparently, to EPA. Although when put under oath, Dr. Belk would not recite those details, which Ms. Pearson stated in her deposition, she would not have known all those histories of things going on unless Dr. Belk had told her about it. And so to us, you know, looking at the broader scope of summary judgment, that's a fact dispute. That goes to the credibility of witnesses. Did Dr. Belk suddenly have amnesia during his deposition testimony? We all of a sudden couldn't recall the topics that were discussed and the very detailed information that he provided to Ms. Pearson in that discussion. Whereas Ms. Pearson can remember it in detail, he did admit he knows he met with her for over an hour. I asked him, well, what did you talk about for that whole, you know, over an hour period of time? That's a pretty long meeting. Oh, I don't really recall the details. I mean, there was a lot of, I don't recall, I don't know. Those things go to credibility of witnesses. So if we look at summary judgment being a blunt instrument under Rule 56, and if we look at, are there disputed matters of material fact that could change the outcome of any of these claims, then the court must be reversed. This matter must be remanded back to the district court for further findings to weigh out the credibility of those witnesses, to weigh out what really did happen, what was known to EPA, what was known to CenterCare of these particular doctors who were working in the emergency trauma room, who did have supervisory tasks and duties over my client, because they admitted, again, this is in deposition testimony that was provided under document number 113. They admitted they clinically do supervise the nurses in the emergency trauma center. So we also have need of the discovery to be able to really assert our claim of a joint type of employer relationship between EPA and CentraCare. They had different roles. Yes.
Thank you for your detailed answers about the discovery issues. I'd like to turn to the issues relating to your Minnesota Human Rights Act claims. I believe you have two separate claims in the amended complaint. And the district court found that the first claim was time barred. And I think you agree in your brief that the time limits set forth in 363A.28 applies and that the applicable period is August 20th through August 2021. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you can point us to some evidence of an unlawful discriminatory act that occurred in that specific period. I'm wondering exactly what evidence you're relying on to suggest that there was unlawful discriminatory conduct during that period, such that
Thank you, Your Honor. So during that period of time, my client was seeking to become re-employed with CentraCare, and that's gets us a little bit into the weeds on the workers' compensation claim. And so typically with those type of claims, the person is trying to get back to work with their current employer. In this case, because my client was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder arising out of what happened with the sexual harassment that she suffered at the emergency trauma center, her treating provider actually determined it was not the best case scenario for her to go back to the ETC itself. And so looking at how large CentraCare is, the goal was to try to return back to work with the same employer, which is often the case in workers' compensation claims. And so throughout that entire summer, I guess if we look at the time period, specifically the summer of 2021, there were different jobs being proposed through a qualified rehabilitation consultant or QRC. Through the workers' comp insurance company, SFM, which is CentraCare. And through that process.
How does proposing of job offers constitute sexual harassment under the Minnesota Human Rights Act?
Well, I apologize. I was speaking more to the retaliation. So through that time, as far as the harassment goes, my client was receiving text messages from other employees wondering what was going on. This speaks more to, I think, the retaliation aspect of it. She was not put back into the
retaliation or a reprisal claim, correct? You brought a sex discrimination claim.
Correct. We did bring,
under the Human Rights Act, to be clear.
Right. So under the MHRA, correct. We brought claims of sexual harassment. Yes. And so after she was no longer employed at the ETC, she continued to get, I guess, retaliated against by her coworkers. As far as sexual harassment goes, she was no longer with the doctors that were the perpetrators of the harassment. And so those particular individuals were not present with her at the time. So I can't speak to her getting harassed by those perpetrators any longer.
But your argument is basically that the job offers were the continuation of the sexual harassment.
Correct, because they were below and far below her abilities. So she was actually, my client obtained not only a nursing degree, but she got a specialty above and beyond that for emergency room, a very fast-paced environment, that kind of a thing.
So these things were like taking
the temperature of someone coming into the room who to see if they had maybe elevated temperature for COVID. Those kind of things were continually putting her down.
You're running short on time. So sure. Were any of those offers after August 2020? So I think the record, as far as I could tell, and your brief didn't really cite to the dates, but as far as I could tell, the offers were around June 2020. Am I incorrect about that?
That was something we argued about too at the summary judgment motion hearing. The offers actually continued throughout that entire summer and into the fall. And it wasn't until October, I think the end of October of 2021, when my client ultimately realized she wasn't going to get an appropriate type of job offer that would be similar in pay and similar to her skills. And she went to Mend Correctional Facility, which is a medical facility inside of the law enforcement center.
Okay, thank you. Then I have a question for you about your other Human Rights Act claim, which is the where you're alleging intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's claim B. And, but you're bringing that under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Is that correct? You're not, you didn't bring a separate tort claim.
Just going to be turning to the page in my brief.
It's in your amended complaint. It's on page 4.
I don't have the key points in front of me. And I'm so sorry. What if you could please restate the question?
I guess my question is for you, basically, it's that your argument relating to your claim relating to intentional infliction of emotional distress, the claim you brought was under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. It wasn't a tort claim.
So in other words, a common law claim. You know, I believe we did bring it under the MHRA, but I guess I cannot speak to that right now because I don't have the complaint in front of me. We would rely on the pleadings and the briefs that are on record and of file with the court.
Okay. And if that is the case, then you would agree that the 1-year time bar applies to that claim as well.
Right. Under 363A.28, as the court had mentioned previously, there would be a 1-year time bar with that, correct? We're not disputing, you know, the language of the statute itself, or that it should be extended into a different manner. I would like to note, though, for the court, that this was during, you know, the year 2020 when the courts were closed. There were several orders that came forth from Governor Walz that did extend filing deadlines for claims. So that was something we did mention and argue about at the district court level as well. Although the 1-year time period was not changed, there was a tolling that occurred during that time. I think that was actually changed and amended by the legislature due to, you know, offices being closed, people not being able to get access. And so we did argue that if there was some sort of a question about whether it was timely or not, that we would look to those extensions that were provided during that time, because that is
but
a question
that
came up.
You argue that in your brief before us.
It was argued at the district court level below, yeah. Correct.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondents, you can proceed when you're ready. I'm not sure who's going first, but you can proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Kelly Gelberg-Nelson. On behalf of respondents, St. Cloud Hospital and CentraCare Health System, may it please the court and counsel. For purposes of my argument, I'm just going to refer to respondents as CentraCare. And summary judgment on all of appellant's claims should be affirmed. I'm going to just touch on each one briefly. First, the Minnesota Human Rights Act claim. The court is already keyed in on the 1-year issue that we have. I've heard nothing in counsel's argument that would indicate that there was any unlawful act that occurred from August 18th of 2020 to August 18th of 2021. She's indicated in the summer some other jobs were proposed, but if we look at what's on the record, the last job offer that was given was June 10th of 2020, and that's in Doc 122 Exhibit N, where she was offered an RN job in the Med-Surg department. So that's outside of the applicable time period that it needs to be. And so that claim fails because it's outside. There's nothing that she's even identified.
Also, in her argument, appellant suggested that there was an employment offer in the fall of 2020. Can you address that?
Yeah, there's nothing in the record that demonstrates that. Appellant at the district court oral argument indicated that there were ongoing job offers throughout the summer. And so the district court allowed appellant additional time through the end of the day to provide those job offers, and that was never produced. The only thing we have in the record regarding job offers was the June 10th, 2020 offer.
With regard to the, to just jump, since you kind of touched on the point, to the whistleblower claims, with regard to the constructive discharge argument, why weren't some of these positions being offered to Ms. Pearson evidence of constructive discharge, given how incompatible she's argued they are with her qualifications?
Well, because we only have evidence of the one job offer in MedSurg, and I don't think that it actually is. If you look at a RN position in MedSurg, it's not actually that insulting of a job offer. Appellant has argued that these job offers were offered to her because it, knowing that it would conflict with her children's work schedule, there's absolutely no evidence of that in the record. So it doesn't establish a constructive discharge claim. There's nothing about, just to jump to the whistleblower claim, there's no evidence that there was ever an adverse employment action. What we have is on May 28th of 2020, she indicated she wouldn't ever be able to return to the ETC. And other than there's no evidence that her working conditions ever changed or that they were somehow intolerable. She received maybe some different than normal looks from people, and she felt that some nurses were ignoring her. But
she alleged that a doctor complained to her about having to do this sensitivity training, and that led her to break out in hives, right? And yep, that happened in the workplace.
Yes, it did. Although I don't think that rises to the level of actually constituting a constructive discharge. She, that issue was addressed by CentraCare when it happened. And other than her feeling that the nurses were ignoring her because she reported Dr. Schippel's behavior, I want to point the court to the whistleblower claim has to be based on her alleged reports about licensure violations, because if it's based on the alleged harassment, then it's precluded by the MHRA's exclusivity provision. So it has to be based on the alleged reports about licensure violations. And there's really no causal link between the two. Nobody knew about her reports about licensure violations. She alleges in her reply that she reported the licensure violations to EPA on April 6th. There's no evidence on the record that Dr. Belk ever shared those reports to anyone at CentraCare. So to say that somehow CentraCare was treating her differently or had an adverse employment action against her because of that alleged report is simply unfounded. It's not anywhere in the record. I'll just briefly touch on the negligent hiring, retention, and supervision claims. First of all, CentraCare did not employ the alleged harassers, so these claims cannot be asserted against it. And also, even if she could assert the claims against CentraCare, they would also be barred by the MHRA's exclusivity provision because they're based on the same set of facts as the MHRA claim. Going back to the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, again, as the court noted, that claim was brought under the MHRA, and so it would be subject to the same one-year period, and it clearly she's outside of that one-year period, so those claims fail. If we also look at, appellant argues in her reply that the conduct of CentraCare constituting these claims was the lack of confidentiality enforced with her report and the retaliation she allegedly faced. Nothing about these passes the boundaries of decency or are so utterly intolerable to civilized the community. So it doesn't satisfy the very elements of the claim, even if the court were going to consider it as a common law claim. The conduct must be extreme and outrageous, and there's simply no extreme and outrageous conduct here. I just want to also briefly touch on the motion to compel issue. There is nothing that appellant has ever identified with regard to CentraCare's discovery that would somehow survive, make her claim survive if she were to have that discovery. In discovery, she says she sought documents that primarily go to negligent hiring and retention claims. Well, I've already addressed that those claims cannot be asserted against CentraCare because they weren't the employers of the alleged harassers. And also, the motion to compel concerned documents that appellant wanted that she never even requested in discovery. And so there's nothing that appellant has ever identified a discovery request that would somehow save her claims. And for all those reasons, I see I'm just running out of time. CentraCare asks that the court affirm the dismissal of all of appellant's claims. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for Emergency Physicians Professional Association, you can proceed when you're ready.
Judge Cochran, we lost your video. Sorry.
That. I'm not sure. Something is going on with my camera that it's turning off by itself. Sorry about that. Thank you. All right. You can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. And may it please the court and counsel. My name is Elaine Luthens, and I'm here with Michael Moberg. We're on behalf of Emergency Physicians Professional Association, which I'll refer to as EPA. In sum, we're asking that this court affirm all of the district court's rulings, both on EPA's motion for summary judgment and on Ms. Pearson's motions to compel discovery. As has been clear, there's a host of issues on appeal, so I'm just going to try to go through as many as I can in this time allowed. To start with Ms. Pearson's MHRA claims, as has been addressed already today, these claims clearly fall outside of the one-year statute of limitations. Ms. Pearson did not initiate this lawsuit until August 10th by serving a complaint on EPA. And in her deposition, she testified that she did not experience any sort of sexual harassment after February 25th, 2020, nor does she allege that she engaged or interacted with EPA in any capacity after she resigned in May of 2020. Because these claims are clearly time barred, dismissal was appropriate on those grounds alone. Even if they weren't, EPA was not Ms. Pearson's employer. It did not owe her any duties under the MHRA because they did not have an employer-employee relationship. Ms. Pearson testified that she knew she did not work for EPA. She knew EPA did not set her schedule, set her pay, that EPA could not terminate her, and therefore her MHRA claims against EPA fail for that reason as well. Lastly,
can you turn to the negligent hiring claim?
Sure.
Judge Ead asked some good questions to appellant, and I would like to ask some similar questions to you. You know, why, given that Helen has a diagnosis of PTSD, I believe. Why isn't that physical manifestation of the hives, why isn't that sufficient to satisfy the physical injury requirement, particularly given that I think our case law is on the older side?
Yeah, so under Minnesota law, to establish either a negligent hiring, negligent retention, or negligent supervision claim, a plaintiff must show that they experienced a physical injury or a threat of physical injury. The court has had opportunities to consider whether or not a psychological injury, even one that may result in some sort of physical injury down the road, is sufficient to satisfy this burden, and it has declined the opportunity to make that finding.
Isn't a threat of physical injury, I mean, couldn't it arguably be a psychological injury? I mean, it includes within its scope, just our current case law, as dated as it might be, not just an actual physical injury, but the threat of a physical injury. And so clearly there's some policy behind that framing that encompasses wanting to prevent employers from retaining or hiring people that will threaten harm, and that's not actual physical harm to anyone. So why wouldn't someone making a comment about sexual harassment and that leading to someone breaking out in hives because of their particular diagnosis, why wouldn't that qualify as a threat of physical injury?
Here, Ms. Pearson's reaction to a comment that was not threatening physical injury is not a threat of physical injury. The case law first acknowledging and recognizing these causes of action and then addressing them in subsequent case law have all been focused on holding employers liable when they hire individuals who they know have a propensity to be dangerous or violent and cause physical harm to others, other third parties. This cannot, if we extend it to any sort of threat that may cause someone anxiety, which may then cause them to experience physical manifestations of that, it would exponentially expand this cause of action to a bunch of different sort of circumstances. Even beyond that, there is no evidence in the record as it stands that EPA knew or had reason to know that any of these individuals were susceptible or likely to physically harm or threaten physical harm upon anyone or any third parties. As Ms. Pearson's counsel argued, she broke out in hives due to conduct from a different doctor than she alleges engaged in sexual harassment against her. There is no evidence that EPA may have known that this doctor that made a comment that he was unhappy about attending a sexual harassment training or whatever she alleges, that EPA knew that he had any sort of past history or proclivity toward dangerous or violent behaviors. So on any which way you look at it, Ms. Pearson's negligent hiring, retention, and supervision claims against EPA fail, and dismissal was appropriate. Turning to the IIED claim, similar to what has already been argued, the facts as they've alleged do not support a finding of fact that could be submissible to the jury on an IIED claim. Courts have repeatedly held that IIED claims are reserved for the most egregious of facts, and the threshold for the standard of proof is extremely high. Even if we took everything that Ms. Pearson alleged here as true, there is no conceivable way that this could satisfy that burden and should be submitted to a jury. Going to the whistleblower claim, similar to the MHRA claim, EPA was not Ms. Pearson's employer, so therefore it could not take an adverse employment action against her to satisfy retaliation in violation of the MWA. Ms. Pearson's claim is based upon a conversation she had with Dr. Kurt Belk on April 6, 2020. And she does not allege that EPA took any sort of actions against her thereafter. She worked two other shifts in the ETC where she did not recall anything notable happening with any EPA physicians. So there are no facts in the record for which Ms. Pearson can allege that EPA retaliated against her for making any sort of report in April. To summarize, EPA did exactly what it was supposed to do in this sort of case. It received notice that one of its employees may have been engaging in sexual harassment in the workplace. It immediately placed that employee on a leave of absence, investigated the claims, and then ultimately terminated his employment within a week. So it's difficult to imagine what more it could have done or what else it should have done under these circumstances. I see my time is out.
Thank you. Any rebuttal by appellant?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Starting with the, the last respondent first, EPA's arguments here today, in terms of their knowledge of any prior issues with any of their physicians, again, this goes to the reason why it was so prejudicial towards the plaintiff or appellant in this matter. in the, you know, in trying to fight off the summary judgment motion by these two respondents.
Can I just ask you about that? So I understood that your negligent hiring and retention claim was related to the doctor who actually sexually harassed your client rather than Dr. Belk, because the physical manifestation of the psychological injury occurred after Dr. Belk's comment to your client about having to do the mandatory sensitivity training. So I think what I understood your counterpart's argument to be is that there really isn't any causal link, because there was no evidence at all that there was some issue about Dr. Belk hiring or retention, that there was any past indication that he was known for making bad comments to people about doing sensitivity trainings. So, I mean, even if we take your argument on its face, we don't have any physical manifestation of the PTSD that your client suffered that relates to the actual person who's the hiring claim relates to, the retention claim relates to. And so can you address that? Because I thought your counterpart's argument was well taken in that regard.
Thank you, Your Honor. So it's actually Dr. Butts is the one who, I know there's these names, Dr. Belk and Dr. Butts are both APA doctors that have letters that are last names that start with the letter B, four letter names, but it's specifically Dr. Michael Butts who approached my client and made her feel that she was being retaliated against. So, I mean, in terms of his acts towards my client, you know, he said, can you hear about this like bullshit? You know, this is a bunch of shit that we have to take this sensitivity training because somebody reported sexual harassment or some kind of crap like that. It was a comment like that, which goes into a lot of detail. It's in the deposition. You know, we don't really know what his past history of sexual harassment may or may not have been, or his propensity for being threatening in the workplace. That's kind of an open question. We don't know that. But I think to your point, yes, we're more looking for the motion to compel documents related to Dr. Schipel and Dr. Johnson, who were the perpetrators of the sexual harassment towards the plaintiff, because Dr. Belk, who was the medical director for EPA, whose office is housed inside St. Cloud Hospital in CentraCare, he's the one who sort of let the cat out of the bag and told my client in a over 1 hour long meeting, yeah, you know, these guys have had some past problems. Schipel came to a work meeting, you know, drunk or under the influence. He's had affairs with two other nurses. One was Julie Trost, if I'm saying it correctly, Trost, I believe. Another nurse, too.
My question was more focused on, there was no evidence in the record that your client suffered any physical manifestation of her psychological injury following the actions of Dr. Schipel and Dr. Johnson. The physical manifestation followed the actions of Dr. Butts, who was not the subject of your negligent hiring and retention claim. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. As far as the sequence of events, yes. I mean, my client experienced PTSD and was, you know, she would shake. She would go to the bathroom and cry. I mean, she was obviously physically shaken by what happened. She testified to that in her deposition as a result of the sexual harassment. But that should not let the hospital or EPA off the hook. I mean, you have a situation here where apparently if you hire out your ETC doctors and they're supervising the nurses who you separately hire through the hospital's employment entity, they can seem to get away with harassing nurses, looking at the ETC as a meat market, like, who do I like? Who do I want to date next? Who do I, whether married, unmarried, doesn't matter. You know, this is just an opportunity now for me to kind of see who I can get in bed tonight. And apparently there's just no recourse for that because, as I've heard today, well, geez, you know, EPA doesn't, you know, employ the nurses, so they're hands free, they're, you know, scot free. And geez, you know, St. Cloud Hospital doesn't employ these doctors. They contract with them, they monitor their employment or their education and training, they grant privileges. They know these doctors have clinical supervision over the nurses, which we heard in testimony from Dr. Belk. If they see one of the nurses screwing up clinically, doing something wrong, not following protocol or procedures, that gets reported. They do have the ability, and we know that they can make reports to CentraCare, to the nurse managers, which would affect their job. So they do hold a level of power and control over those nurses. And so, you know, I guess looking at the broader policy questions here, how can this be? It seems like, you know, they found some sort of a loophole to be able to do this and, you know, do it without any type of accountability for these people. And again, you know, looking at the doctor's histories, I think that's really important. And I understand the court's questions earlier, but, you know, how can any plaintiff then present a claim and provide evidentiary support for their claim if we're not getting even the personnel handbook of EPA? We were denied that. We don't even know what their own standards of behavior were.
Your time is up.
Oh, so I apologize. Thank you.
That's all right. If you can, I actually have one, I think, what is a quick question for you, and then you could briefly sum up. But you had mentioned that you thought there, going back to the time bar issue, you had thought that there were some offers in the fall of 2020. The hospital's attorney suggests that the last offer in the record is, in terms of what the record reflects, was June 2020. Can you give us a cite to in the record to an offer in the fall of 2020?
You know, Your Honor, I've thought about that, and I was trying to look into what we had submitted for our summary judgment motion to support that. And what we have are QRC reports, qualified rehab consultant reports. I may be able to clarify that a little bit, because as far as something on a CentraCare's letterhead, that may be the June date, but you have to understand that as time went on and it became clear through my client's treating physician that she could not go back to the ETC due to her diagnoses, they started working through the workers' comp insurance company to find her employment, not at St. Cloud Hospital proper, but at any of the 130 clinics that CentraCare has throughout central Minnesota. I mean, it's a very large, large system. And so through that process of the workers' compensation QRC, her name is Dana Butler, and we did provide some reports in the record for that, and I apologize. I don't have the document ID number for it. I would point to those, because those were the way that the communication was going back and forth between CentraCare via the workers' comp system, and that's how that typically plays out.
All right, thank you. If you want to briefly sum up, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. So the main points I wanted to bring forward today were that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to essentially put a hold on the motion to compel discovery for the plaintiff and then rule on the summary judgment, which then dismissed all of plaintiff's claims before actually looking at the documents themselves with the in-camera review. We feel that's a really important issue, especially given that EPA conceded at oral argument that plaintiff was entitled to that in-camera review to determine the privileged basis of the documents that were claimed to be withheld that were relevant, but were withheld based on different privileges. We feel that's a really important matter, because that would have helped plaintiff to support her claims. We don't know what was in there, and it's difficult to fight these claims off, or the summary judgment motion off, without, you know, really being able to kind of get all the information that was there. As to CentraCare with the motion to compel, that was another issue we felt was really important. We'll rest on our briefing, and thank you for the extended time.
Okay. Thank you very much to all three counsel here today. Your arguments have been very helpful, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.